The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill goes into the global Big Five CPA firm consulting business. John goes without Christmas presents because he has presence of mind. Simpson talks AI for defense. Doug talks about ethics and exploitation. Dave discusses breakthroughs in marketing technologies only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m., join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. According to unnamed sources on the street, during the good old days in Pacific Grove last weekend, there was an internet outage of staggering proportions. Chris was unable to get email while talking to me live on the air. Fortunately, the problem cleared up after a few minutes when we discovered the PC had its screen lock on. That's breaking news on The Cyber Show.
And now a word from our sponsor. Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m., join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
You know, this whole thread keeps coming through to today. Surprise, surprise. We're here with Bill talking about all the things from the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s, which we still need to do today, right?
Absolutely.
So you did this at IBM for a while, and I didn't realize you were there in the mid-80s, but at some point you moved from IBM into other things, right?
Well, I retired from IBM in 1986 after 30 years. I have now been out of IBM longer than I was in it, but I then went into consulting, first for Ernst & Young, then for Deloitte & Touche, then for TrueSecure, entrepreneurial effort done by Peter Tippett.
So you left IBM and you went into these one after another consulting. So I remember when you were at the big consulting firms, and you've got to tell us about the big consulting firms, because those are, my goodness, they were the biggest players in the consulting field with the largest enterprises for the longest time.
I went to Ernst & Young when I retired from IBM under David Wilson of the Clark Wilson model fame. And I was there for about 3 years. I say Ernst & Young, actually it was Ernst & Winnie. And at the end of the 3 years, they did the merger with Arthur Young and became Ernst & Young. At that point, they had difficulty managing the merger. And so they went back to basics. And they said, we were going to do audit and tax, and we're going to get rid of this security practice. So I left them and went with Deloitte. It turned out that for them, they couldn't get out of the security practice as much as they wanted to. The phone kept ringing. and when I managed data security support programs for IBM, we had six people. IBM had, my recollection is they had 400 people working security internal to IBM. But for the customer support, there were six of us. And the function that I managed then is now a major line of business for IBM. But in those days, there were only six of us. Now it's a huge business area for IBM, a big source of revenue. And of course, it's true for the accounting firms. All of them have consulting practices in security that go back to the generally applied accounting controls. I mean, it's simply the application of those controls to modern systems that constitutes what we now think of as cybersecurity.
Well, for the financial part of it, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's lacking from the GAAP controls, again, generally accepted accounting principles, but the fundamentals of things like separation of duties, you know, that certainly belongs and is being ignored. So,
and we see all kinds of situations today, problems that arise that simply require multi-party controls. But, you know, what do we do about privileged users? And I say, we do multi-party controls. And if we have two people that have to cooperate, the chances that there's going to be a problem go down.
They do. There have been occasional situations where financial institutions have had two, in some cases, an entire office of a bank colluding to steal money from the bank. But those are rare, and they're also almost always caught after the fact, right?
Yeah. In the early days of computing, we worried about how to control the tellers. And I said, you know, tellers steal little and get caught early. It's officers who steal a lot and get caught late.
And, yeah, but officers don't like you to check on them.
Right.
Well, and we have the same problem today, right? It's the people on top don't want to follow the rules they give everybody else, right?
Right.
So another interesting thing about what you said, in the financial arena, we always have these controls, these thresholds that say at this position or this level in the organization, you can only damage us by so many dollars, right? So you can't spend more than this much money with your position. You need an approval for the higher threshold of spending. But in cybersecurity, we don't do that. We don't associate the potentially serious negative consequences associated with positions and things that people are authorized to do with the thresholds associated with their level of trust, I'll call it, within the organization. And that seems to be one of the big missing parts. It's not missing from the understanding how to do it. It's missing from the actually doing it part, right?
We know what to do. We lack the will.
Well, yeah. So I agree when you say we know, you and I know. But there are lots and lots of people who don't have the background in education and knowledge. So this brings us to a whole other line of questioning here, Bill, because long ago you were one of the founders of the CISSP and that whole concept. And I want to talk about that next.
Okay.
We start to, there are so many fundamental, relatively simple things that have been understood probably for millennia, which we just don't do.
Well, after the last segment, you know, I sort of argued on the chaos versus order side of things, right? You know, and the fact that, you know, we're still at a medium maturity level with cybersecurity, information security writ large. But this time I'm going to go the opposite direction, right? You and Bill are actually right. You know, all of it, you know, to my previous point may not be settled, a lot of it is. And it's all, boy, I've always loved operational technology and engineering, cyber environments, because at the end of the day, physics doesn't change. You know, and the heat generated by a bearing in this situation is what it is, right? And, you know, doing these three things in this order, you know, is the right way to do it, right?
And so, having the train not derail because you bothered to not let the temperature get over the spec,
right?
You know, saves lives. And
this is one of my favorite little things, a little bit of a bit tangent, but in the 1800s, you know, railroad engineers put bimetallic coatings on the drive wheel bearings on steam locomotives. So the engineers would be able to smell it when the heat got to a certain level, right? You see it nodding your head, you understand, right? And that is a very mechanical, cognitive, dare I say, cyber integration right there, right? Physical properties that are always going to be what they are need to mix with this patterns in people's heads or in computers, you know, that we run things on.
Right. So part of the problem is that when you go into the modern cyber environment, you go away from these simple things that work. This is back to the simplicity principle, right? And there are good reasons for it. And in fact, if you do it well, you can do it way, way better than the smell test, right? That is to say, the train will know that it has to slow down, and the other trains on the track will know that they're going to run into that slowed down train if they run their normal schedule and they all adapt. However, that's not what happens very often in reality. You know, my wife lives, you know, in the same house with me, but I'm upstairs and she's downstairs. And so when she's going to go out for a walk, rather than come upstairs and yell, she texts me. Okay. So now that text message doesn't come from here to there. It goes probably, you know, a couple hundred miles, you know, and through certainly hundreds, maybe thousands of computers before it gets here. Oh, you know, 5 seconds later, and I hear her go out the door. You know, we used to have an intercom when I was young in our house, which was a local intercom. It was analog. You flip the switch and you can talk to another room, or you can push the button and talk to all. And it was up there on the wall. But that era is gone, except maybe at my house. So there are big advantages to the automated mechanisms we put in place. And in the large scale, they have tremendous benefits. The problem is that locally, the failures tend to harm the people that are local to them.
Well, you know, it's a common problem of every generation to say, you know, look at the negative, you know, aspects of the newness, right? And, you know, steam locomotives are a great example, right? People, unless you're a train geek, you don't understand that in the 1800s, the train builders were, that was Silicon Valley. Those are the hackers, the geeks, you know, steam engines explode. That was the problem, you know, killing a lot of people, you know, when you're experimenting with these things. And then to the point of the bimetallic bearings and using the engineer's brain to reduce the damage. It turns out that if you start running trains on tracks a lot, you know, by the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, turns out they were dangerous as, you know, it didn't explode all the time, but they crashed constantly. So now we're actually, you know, the physics are all working. Now we need to get the process. And at that point, the human brain in the engineer was capable of taking, you know, micromolecules in the air and turn that into a decision process, which is a lot like, you know, everything you and I talk about, right? You know, at which point now are we? How much do we need to actually do?
So when you look at these evolutions, airplane, you know, safety in air travel, that's one of the most impressive things ever, right? That is the rate of accidents in air travel where people, you know, get killed is so small now. I mean, it's unbelievably small compared by a long way to what it used to be. And there's all, you know, they find the technical things and fix them. But process is almost certainly the major element. The checklist, it's not complicated. There's a checklist. It's not on a computer. It's on a pad or whatever it is, you know, a little mechanical thing. And you say, oh, do this. Did it? Yes, confirmed. Slide the slide over. Okay.
Right.
And you do that checklist and you know, the landing gear is always down.
Yes.
They're always down. And so systematically over, you know, decades, they have basically eliminated all of those accidents except, you know, we had a runway here where one plane was just going too fast and ran into the plane in front of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, okay, guess what, guys? And there's, you know, intentional pilot malice and pilot error, but even pilot error has been dramatically reduced because the automation to detect things and the requirement for two pilots and so forth. And now we're coming out with the, you know, the next generation of this stuff, Joby Aviation and all these companies, but they're being forced to meet those same requirements. They have all the same process issues and so forth. This is a tremendous advantage of what can happen in an industry when it's deemed important enough. And the question is, when and under what circumstances are we going to get there in the cyber arena? And, you know, the president, you know, has just come out with their, you know, this year's version of the cybersecurity plan for the country and starts to try and talk about that stuff. But we really need the NTSB for National Transportation Safety Board. We really need that same sort of process for all the critical infrastructures. And we sort of have it, but it's not the same force that we have on airlines. You know, it's not something where they can say to Norfolk Southern, sorry, you're shut down, or they won't say you're shut down until you fix this problem on every train. You can no longer run these engines. You're going to have to what? Buy other engines that don't have the problem. And all those sorts of things, if we start to do those in the other critical infrastructures over decades, we'll get to the point where we don't have any of those problems anymore. Or at least they're so rare as to be inconsequential. And The other side of that is under attack, things are much more complicated because almost all those train, you know, those failures were just, you know, mechanical
breaking. Yes.
Yeah. They weren't people intentionally putting trains on the same track going the opposite directions.
Well, trains and planes are a good example. In 2006, I gave a talk on cyber risk to airports at an airfield illumination annual conference, which is a thing. Who knew?
Yeah.
And an FAA director gave a talk at that same event, and where his point was, they don't think they can actually prevent another crash by analyzing any more crashes. Now, you learn things, you know, but just statistically, the way it's gone, you know, aviation safety at the beginning of the aviation industry was awful. Better than rail safety was at the beginning of rail. Beginning of rail, getting on a rail train was basically, you know, a long version of suicide. To the point, you know, commercial aviation now is ridiculously safe. You're just about as likely to be killed by almost anything else, right? You know, left-handed orange screwdrivers flying on a Tuesday, right? Yeah, so but in short, I agree. You know, I think we're at the point right now where we can. It's reasonable to say I'm an 1890s rail line. I can't put in computer controls. It would bankrupt me. I wouldn't have a rail line. You know, there's a time and a place for everything, but this stuff works. We have enough process in the air example, in air infrastructure, and we have enough technology today to actually implement.
And stop making the same stupid mistakes.
Process, yes. Process, yeah. Process.
Stop making the same stupid mistakes. How many times does an input overrun, which we're going to hear more about from Bill later, which you're going to find very interesting, how long does that have to keep happening? And Bill has a wonderful potential solution to that, which we will get to. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
So, John, the CIA had an advanced program in counterintelligence, and you were running counterintelligence for you. So tell us about, you know, the, sort of the next steps in your career and where it drove.
Well, of course, I was very successful at Santa Barbara Research Center. In fact, in the first year I was there, I discovered that they were woefully out of compliance with then Defense Logistics Agency requirements for secure information. And I had gone to the vice president, who was the general manager of Santa Barbara Research, and I said, look, we really need to fix this. Because if someone comes in and catches some of this, one of the most egregious one was that we had a test facility where all of these detectors went on a test board, and they would sit there for 3 days while pneumatic tests and other kinds of tests were being done on them. And this room didn't even have a lock on it. And of course, these detectors were secret as they stood there.
Anybody could walk in. And
well, not anyone could walk into our facility, but if you could get into the facility, then anyone could have walked in. Yeah. But the really significant part of that was that about roughly 3 or 4 weeks later, I got called up to the general manager's office. And there was a guy there sitting in a chair with a big handlebar mustache. This guy was probably 45 years old. And he said, John, he said, I want to introduce you to Special Agent da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We've just been served with a suspension notice for all of our classified work.
Oh, that hurts.
And I said, oh, can I take a vacation?
And to which the answer was definitely no.
Well, I didn't know this guy from Adam, right? So Lloyd Scott was the general manager. I remember him very well. And I met the senior agent that had come out. And I said to him, I said, well, as I recall, generally you all give us a 30-day notice and give us 30 days to right the ship, if you will, and then come back and reinspect, and we go on from there. And he said, well, that's true, John. And since you're fairly new here, I'm inclined to do that.
Oh, so, nice job, John. You saved us for a lot of trouble.
Well, Lloyd was ecstatic because he had contract deliverables that he had to make. You know? And so after the special agent left, Lloyd brought in the COO and a guy by the name of Al Paul and myself. And he said, okay, John, what's it going to take? I said, look, two things. It's going to take me telling everybody what to do.
And them doing it.
We don't have time for long discussions. We don't have time for studies. We don't have time to generally look for 13 different knitters or, you know, things like that. I said, they gave us a list of what they consider unacceptable. We got to fix that in 30 days.
Yep, you make it acceptable in 30 days, and that's that.
Yeah. So, and I said, so the other thing that's going to happen is I probably am going to get dropped from the Christmas list of most of our employees.
So goes it.
So I said, the point is here, we can make this happen if we work together as a team. And now you got to understand that the employment makeup of Santa Barbara Research Center was about a third PhD scientist. But that was the research center, right?
Sure.
And then there was about a third, I would say, practicing professionals in one discipline or another. And then a third in the manufacturing piece parts and stuff like that. So shipping, receiving, document control, you know, that kind of stuff. At that time, I had become in charge of security, technical library, facility communications, which means I had the switchboard and all that crap.
Yep.
And safety, health and safety. And in that time frame was when OSHA was being considered and passed. So,
oh, goodness. Okay. So you get double whammy or so, yeah.
It was a busy, busy time. So everything went well. We got it taken care of. And a matter of fact, the government was so happy that the following, it was about a year and a half later, we won the very prestigious Cogswell Award, which is an award in those days that DOD only awarded two per year, one for large companies and one for smaller companies. Mm-hmm. And a brigadier general would be sent out to make the award, the presentation, and all of that kind of stuff. Now, just to give you...
What was your rank when you left the military?
My rank when I left the military was classified.
The rank was, oh, okay. Well, so, all right. Presumably it still was classified, or?
Yeah, well, it wouldn't. My veterans forms the last time I went into the Veteran Administration, which has been several years now, they said, what was your rank, John? And I said, it was classified. And as far as I know, now it may be unclassified today, I don't know. I said, I didn't get a lot of money. Let's put it that way.
Have you encountered brigadier generals before?
No. I was no...
private, give or take. All right, so this was quite a step up, right?
Right. So, and there was a reason for that because, what I was told, the reason for it was because I had become known in a couple of countries, and they simply didn't want to provide an information trail to me. So
and that's why you still can't visit some of those countries. Is that right?
Correct.
That's right. All right. So now what happened next?
Well, to make a long story short, my prognostications about getting kicked off Christmas lists came true.
Imagine that.
Okay, there you go.
So nothing changes, right?
Well, I mean, so first of all, you know, when you get called into a meeting and you show up and there's a special agent from the FBI, generally that would get your hackles up. That's like, excuse me, am I under arrest? You know, what's going on? I don't think I did anything wrong, but you never know. And so a surprise meeting with the FBI can never be a good thing. And then, but the wherewithal to say, well, usually you get 30 days, right? I don't know whether he actually knew that or he made it up, but okay, well, you're new here. We'll give you 30 days. Oh, man. So his boss has got to be, oh, John, you saved me from a fake worth. And, you know, because this is a place that's doing massive amounts of classified research. Their whole programs are classified, and it's just going to shut the whole company down or a significant part of it. And, you know, that would be just horrible. So he gets his 30 days. And his comment about Christmas cards.
You know, I don't know if you were the first person to say this, but you associate this with this, you know, the consulting as a performance art. And I would go so far as to say our entire careers are, right? And you know, I've had an interesting day. And as I sit here listening to John and think about this, you know, I don't know if I've had a surprise visit with FBI agents before. I'd have to really stop and think because, yeah, it's been a long and winding road, hasn't it? With all the guests on this show, all the friends, you know, these, and we're having a lot of these conversations these days, right? And, as we do, getting off topic a little more contemporaneous, right? You know, it's interesting. We're constantly saying, all right, but we have to know where we've been to talk about where we are and what we do about going where we're going, right? And, you know, the changes and lack of changes, you know, with each of the guests, and John's a perfect example, right? You know, how did this look 30, 40 years ago? What was that about? And, oh, it's still about like that. It just is.
Right. The news recently, of course, we hear about, you know, some 21-year-old or whatever who's in the military who has access to gobs of classified information and, I guess, takes it off of printer, court, you know, fold it up in his pants and walk out. You know, it's just ridiculous that we haven't moved anywhere from then. But, you know, he had discovered all this stuff and told his boss about it ahead of time, which is, you know, in terms of your standing as a worker, when you bring that stuff to bosses, they never seem to like it. And you always very much often get slammed for it.
Yep.
And you could lose your job for it, you know, because just the fact that they now know means potential liability or something. But then to have the FBI come in and be Johnny on the spot, literally Johnny on the spot. and then, well, there's only two things, you know, I'm going to tell you what to do and then you're going to do it. That's called taking command of a situation, right?
It's yeah, it's the times they notice and the times they don't, right? You know, and one of your classic stories, you know, some of the first viruses in the world on a computer disk, you know, borders, and they look at everything except that, right? You know, and I've enjoyed this all my life, right? You know, just be standing in a situation and saying, all right, you know, this should be of interest to XYZ. Will they notice? No, right? Most of the time. So it's really these exceptions, they're very rare exceptions. You know, all the things we talk about, it's like, quite often, John, you and I, and, a lot of our peers have worked with, governments, nation state governments, quite often, ours and others, right? So it's not, there's nothing nefarious about it, folks, but, it is
merely incompetence.
Right. Well, but it's hopeful, right? I was telling my daughter this just earlier today, that you look around the world and realize nothing's done perfectly and still we get along, right? That should give you a lot of confidence, right? No individual, no group, no country or anything else is, the CIA and the FBI are not out there perfectly executing on some utopian scheme. They're getting by just like the rest of us, one step at a time.
Right. Yeah, people make mistakes. They're imperfect. They get bored. The tasking is too difficult realistically to do repeatedly the same thing again and again and again. Computers are very good at this and say right. Much lower failure rates, but they, what is it to err as human, to really foul things up? It takes a computer.
Right. And this is where we stand with AI, with machine learning, right? We have this opportunity. It could be nefariously used, but I see, enormous opportunities. Exactly that. We've had people, you look back in the industrial age, you have somebody literally doing the same physical motion over and over and over and over and over 16 hours a day, right? It's not the best use of human skills. To achieve the task, quite often these AI, these machine learning systems will be really, really useful because they won't get bored.
They might. they just haven't learned enough to get bored.
Yeah.
All right. There's one other thing I wanted to bring up. I have never heard anybody tell me their rank is classified.
Right? I didn't mean either. That's an interesting one.
I mean, how do they know who to salute and when? And I have a couple theories about it. One of them is, you've seen these movies like The Hunt for Red October, and the CIA guy comes in and his rank is apparently an admiral while he's on that ship, and he gets saluted. He has the uniform. He's an admiral. When he goes somewhere else, he might be something else completely different.
Right.
But it's interesting that it's because he was in various places and they wanted to make it harder to track him back. So imagine that you were, in some intelligence operation somewhere and you were acting as the rank as colonel and under a false name, so I'm Colonel Johnson, right? So Colonel Johnson was there. Well, they look up Johnson. There is no Colonel Johnson, but if it was actually a colonel, then they could go back and say, all right, well, what are all the colonels, that have been traveling? And you could do some correlation and such. So if you don't know the rank and you don't know the name, then it's just somebody in the military. Well, that's not much of a clue. So maybe that's it, right?
Well, it's all about hacking the system, right? This is, again, the stories of Bletchley Park, right? The enigma of World War II, Alan Turing and all this stuff, moving people around. Right. The real stories and the good fiction like Cryptonomicon. Right. Two generations later, the grandchildren asking grandma, it's like, why didn't grandpa have a Navy uniform and an Army uniform? It's like, well, sometimes he'd wear one and sometimes he'd wear the other. You hack the system. Right.
Or those of us with no uniform.
Right.
All right, let's figure out what happens next.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the cyber show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
We're going to be talking to Dave Bailey for a few weeks about the RSA show that was last week. I've worked with Dave for many years. He's a sales and marketing and cybersecurity. So here we go. So the first observation you make there, I'm going to attribute that to breakthroughs in marketing technology, right?
We could say that's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, right, the, zero trust is, just so much baloney. And we know that for sure.
Yeah.
Because if you, you must trust, if you cannot trust anything, you cannot do anything, like, you can't walk out of your door.
So, absolutely correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
The second one.
AI.
AI, yeah. Everybody seems to want to. I don't know how AI tied into a lot of these vendors, but somehow their marketing people told them that we better have AI in our marketing pitch somewhere this year. So I saw a lot of that.
Yeah, that's because of ChatGPT, right?
Sure.
The global attention, the interest, the big boost of, oh, my gosh, followed by, oh, yeah, you know. And so that curve is still taking place. So that's going to be a wave that runs through things. And the use of AI just to make things more efficient, it's getting to the point where it's useful to the general public, if nothing else, for drafting something. And so you can then fix it to get it true, but they can sound good. And so those are all changes that, like the calculator, you know, they're going to get infused into everything else in our society. So, but then the other one that you mentioned is passwordless. And that has been a breakthrough, certainly since the 1980s.
Right. It's been coming a long time. Still, we're still basically very chained to passwords, let's face it. But the other thing at the show, I thought, and this has been a reoccurring theme for many years now, is the migration to cloud security. And that still seems to be huge.
Well, the migration to the cloud. Right. Yeah. Anywhere you go, if you're bringing value with you, you need to have some appropriate level of protection. So wherever you're going to go, you're going to have security, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. So
the move to the cloud is driving security in the cloud, but it's the same stuff. They're selling the same stuff into the cloud that they were selling not into the cloud. It's just that the cloud has, the market has moved, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. So you just need to pivot, as they say, with that trend. But virtually everybody there has some cloud security, intertwined into their product pitch. And I'm trying to look at some of the other notes I had here. There was a lot of threat detection vendors there this year, Fred. I kind of stopped counting after about 20 of them. But there was certainly a plethora of those guys claiming to minimize threat detection or maximize threat detection, I should say.
Threat detection is an interesting term because most of the ones I heard talking about threat detection were not talking about threats. They were talking about vulnerabilities or exploits, not threats.
Yes.
And so, and in fact, I have a recording of one that's a classic of that, right? So we're here at RSA with Lumu. All right. So where did you get the name?
So the name comes from the word light in
Esperanto.
So it's the Esperanto word for light. And you enlighten us about what?
Any threats across the network, IOCs, contact with malicious adversaries.
Okay, so we use all these initials. You know, people on the radio don't understand that stuff. So IOCs are indicators of compromise.
Yeah, indicators of compromise.
And when you say threats, those aren't threats. Those are indicators.
Right.
So there are things that are threats. There are people, nature, those are actual threats.
Yeah.
Like when I look at you, I can see really threatening, right?
No.
No. All right. Well, so fortunately we're on the radio, so they can't see me, so they can just hear my voice. So my voice sounds threatening, right?
No.
No.
Why would it?
So I guess you wouldn't detect me.
No.
No. Well, all right. So I got to tell you, as threat actors go, I'm the top of the top. You won't find any more severe threat actor than me.
Okay.
So, all right. That's Lumu. You can catch him at the RSA. So, threats, for the people that haven't heard the terminology used this way, we're talking about, threat actors, nature, human beings, groups, and so forth of different types. When people say, I'm finding a threat, what they're really typically looking for is indicators of compromise, which is to say, known attack mechanisms have been used, they leave patterns, and their processes search for those patterns to tell you that this Trojan horse or this piece of malware is present in your system, or you're being communicated with from a known site that's being used to exploit other systems.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, and one topic as I walk the floor, this was a big topic, I'm thinking 5 years ago, which was, I think, the last time I was at the show, because then the pandemic hit and they didn't have it for a couple of years. But I didn't see a whole lot on blockchain, Fred. Did you see much blockchain?
Thankfully not.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of that 5 years ago, but I didn't see much of it this show.
Yeah, well, one of the fundamental reasons is I think the marketing people have finally come to realize that, and by the way, that's not true in the startup community. They're still pushing blockchain because it's a buzzword that sells. Yeah. But I think the marketing people have come to realize that the buzzword does not produce any value to anybody. It doesn't matter whether you used a blockchain to do it or a database to do it or some other technology, just who cares? because the value to the customer is what it does for them, not the underlying technology.
Sure.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details, or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist. Well, clearly automation is central to any sort of cyber defense these days, just because of the high volume of information and the need to select out and do analysis of such high volume. So there's no hope of even looking at audit trails without automation these days, where it used to be you looked at audits to determine if somebody was violating a rule. Now there's no hope.
Well, based on my experience, nobody actually looks at audit trails. They never did.
Oh, no. Well, I've looked at them in examining systems and found people and things going wrong.
It's very rare for that to actually happen. Like, usually if you're looking at an audit trail, you already have reason to suspect that something happened bad. But it's very rare that people actually scan their log files.
People don't do that because there's automation. If they're going to bother, they'll use automation.
Mm-hmm. So at multiple federal agencies, I have tried to get the log files, and I've been told no, nobody looks at those log files, or that we automatically delete the log files because they get too big. I've never been able to successfully look at log files.
Yes, well, I have, but that's fine. I'm not saying that you should. But there's basically anything in cybersecurity has got to have automation. There's no hope without it because the attackers are largely automated and in high volume.
And that's always been the case.
No, it has not always been the case, but it certainly has been the case for a long time.
Oh, we've always used some level of automation.
There's no way to even see a trace from a computer operation without automation.
That's correct.
It's inherent. Correct. I mean, yeah.
Now, there are people who teach digital forensics that are still teaching people to read hex dumps of directory listings, and I just do not understand the reason to do this.
I still remember how to do that. And occasionally I do that, not necessarily for directory listings on a disk, but for components within a file. But the thing about it is that's automation.
Yes, obviously. That is absolutely automation. And the challenge is to make that automation responsive, make it learn from mistakes, make it trainable. So there's many, many opportunities there. I was at a conference a few months ago, looking at security issues with AI, both the simple adversarial things and the data poisoning attacks, but on a deeper level, how can we use AI in traditional cybersecurity practices? And that's still largely an open problem. Well, because the AI is a little different than vanilla automation, because it's automation that can learn from training data. So if you're doing traditional automation, your program is learning because there's a human being who is developing that program and modifying it over time for each time it gets things right.
Oh, but you know, correlation is a traditional technique, and you do correlation, and that's learning in almost exactly the same way as creating graphs instead of correlates, right? So you can do it with tables or graphs. It's there.
Absolutely. And with the deep learning, you just have the ability to do it with millions of parameters at once. And so...
Yeah,
and,
but again, that's just another version of automation, right? That's just APL with more memory.
Sure.
There you go. It all comes around. And eventually they will allow us to program in APL on these big machines, but they have new languages for these machines that are very much like APL. They use things like IOTA and Rho. They just call them different things.
Absolutely.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m., join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
Now, on to our next service provider.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena. So I'm back with Doug, and we were talking about how when you work across many companies and develop long-term relationships with people in different situations over many years and keep following research over many years, you start to have a broader understanding of the nature of the world and the way things work, and you've seen more things. You know, I've seen this movie is one of the phrases we use.
Yes.
At some point, everybody I know starts to come to the realization, usually later in their career, of the social implications of what they're doing and of the interaction between the technology and the society.
Yeah.
And in some sense, their inability to control it.
Yeah.
And perhaps the desire to have good outcomes for the world, not just good financial outcomes for the company that chooses to exploit this stuff.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the ethical and moral issues that you've encountered in your work. Now, you're largely in the identity management space as opposed to the crime side of the cyberspace. Right.
Yeah, I suppose so. You know, a lot of the work that I have done over the years has been around patient health information that's, you know, HIPAA protected.
Health Information Portability and Accountability Act.
Yep, yep. Financial information. Very sensitive information that needs to be protected at, you know, at high cost. I was going to say at all costs, but needs to be protected accordingly. And so, you know, what we tend to deal with the senior management when we're proposing solutions or architecture strategies, et cetera, is to really focus on protecting that sensitive information. Because how do I put it to you? Just because you have it in your data center, even now today, most people don't even have it in their data center. It's in the cloud somewhere. But you think you have it protected within its own kind of castle moat. There are still all of these applications that are accessing it, and people are interfacing with those applications, and so the web can become very complex. And so from a, you know, I say from an ethical standpoint, it becomes really important to make sure that our customers understand how, or why, and how to protect that information, because it's not always apparent where it can be misused, if you know what I mean.
You brought up the word why.
Mm-hmm.
And not the letter Y. And right. One of the challenges with Y is that computers do not have any conception at all of this notion of Y.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Who, what, where, when, how? Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
But why? No, it just doesn't go in there.
No. Nope. Right?
It's incompatible with the whole underlying conceptualization of computers, I guess.
Yeah.
And so the Y turns out to be maybe the most important thing.
Yep.
For people. And you were talking about risk management before.
Yep.
And maybe the most valuable thing to understand. And in the world of, you know, ChatGPT and large language models and AI and all this other stuff, there are two things I see in those worlds that are disturbing to me. One of them is they're so lightweight in terms of what they seemingly understand. They don't understand anything.
Correct.
So they put out this tremendously compelling statements of what's gobbledygook, right?
A little better than word salad.
It's better than word salad. It's more like, you know, like a lasagna, like word lasagna.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one of the challenges. But the other big challenge is that it's so hard for people to tell the difference between somebody who knows and doesn't know. It takes an expert to tell an expert.
Yeah.
And with the quantity of frauds going on in the world and the ability to emulate an expert very easily with minimal effort by using, you know, automation, trying to get that differentiated becomes more and more important to the world.
Yes.
And and as somebody that has a tremendous amount of expertise and also, I should say, a tremendous capacity to build relationships.
Thank you.
What is it that allows you to be successful and will continue to be successful at getting good information, good decision-making done with regard to these risks?
You know, I hate to use the phrase fear-mongering because I try not to go down that path. But nevertheless, that is probably one of the greatest motivators in terms of risk management that I've been able to kind of articulate. You know, it's always like you don't want to be Anthem Healthcare. You don't want to be Target. You know what I mean? You don't want that to happen to you, especially if you're the CIO, right? You could end up in prison for some of these things if you're, you know, really lax in terms of decision making.
Now, that does sound like fear-mongering, and so I don't always bring that up because I think it's common knowledge now. But what people don't understand is, number one, what data, well, they probably understand to a degree if there's regulatory compliance associated with things like HIPAA and financial services, PCI, DSS, et cetera, like I was talking about. But they don't understand necessarily how to economically, efficiently, yet securely protect that information. And that's really where, you know, try to focus on educating them on doing the right thing. And when I say the right thing, I want to use the word the minimum. Minimum does not necessarily mean bad. It means not overprotecting. It means understanding where the demarcation points are for storing, handling, and representing the data. And the, you know, the proxy kind of interface above that that would allow certain things, again, with identity management, to see that data. But you need to be able to articulate that these things are imminently solvable, right, through technology, so long as you understand what the issues are and you know where the minimal amount of protection will be satisfactory. Does that make sense?
We talk about reasonable and prudent.
Yeah, that's better than minimal. Yes.
Well, when you, so minimal, you know, is the minimally, when people talk about best practice, usually what they mean is minimally acceptable practice. And usually that's not actually defined.
Right. So you know what I mean.
I do. But yeah, there's a huge challenge here.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I talk to a lot of early stage CEOs. And I'm going to talk about something I talk about now frequently. Nobody actually wants security.
No.
And that's completely reasonable that they shouldn't want it. But something that they do want, I believe, is identity management.
Yeah.
Right? You would like to know who's doing what. It's not some big, bad security thing.
Right.
It's just knowing, you know, who and what and where and how, you know, just those basic facts. That's so you can answer them.
Yeah. It translates to the analog world perfectly. Don't you like to know who that guy is who's outside your door and what he's doing and how long he's been, you know, all those kinds of things you need to know, right?
You do. The other side of it is when you get to the ethical issues here,
yeah,
all this information on who is where all the time and what they're doing and what they've purchased and all this aggregation of information, and then its use for exploitive purposes is problematic. Yeah. And there is no technical solution to people being exploitive. There's no magical software I'm going to write that's going to say, oh, you can do things in your business that aren't exploitive.
Yeah.
No, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
So how do you address, or do you address, these sort of ethical issues? Or is that just by choosing your customers?
Yeah, I think it's partly that. But again, I think this decentralized identity movement might have, you know, something to help there, because remember I mentioned you don't have to have 1,000 different entities have the same piece of information. You should be able to own that information and share it with them and not allow them to store it. That's the key. That's probably where the big problem is.
Not allowing. The problem here is there are no real rules and there's no enforcement mechanism for the rules.
I know.
So anything I learn about you, I can store and use however I want. And yeah, even if it's illegal, that would only stop the people.
I know. I don't have the answer to that other than to say that if we can do things more in a Boolean, are you this or are you not, rather than give me your a copy of your driver's license so that I can take all the information and just to know that you actually have a driver's license. You know what I'm saying?
This gets really interesting to me. There are these two concepts going at each other. One of them is, if you come to my door and you want in my door, I should be able to ask anything I want. It's my door. And if you don't tell me, I don't have to let you in. The other side of that is, that's a basis for discrimination. We talk about the nature of our society. No, I can't have a public service that only serves people that look like me. That's not allowable in the modern society. Okay, so now that's sort of part one of the challenge of how much we can ask or should ask or what have you. The other side of it is this fascinating idea that Doug comes up with here. That's the idea that if I'm going to rent a car from you, you don't need my driver's license. You just need to know that I have a driver's license that meets the criteria for renting this car. And that if something goes awry, the car, maybe also I, can be found. But you don't need to know who I am, where I live, and all that stuff in order to rent me the car.
Well, you know, you guys were talking about ethics, right? You know, and I believe in two things that combine actually very nicely that I don't think a lot of people would agree with. But there's a utopian ideal of ethics, right? You know, none of us actually live it, but, you know, there is the ethical thing to do, and there's the ethical framework, and it's relatively arbitrary. It's a human thing. It's not physics, but I think ethics are a thing. And I believe in the utopian ideal, the Platonic ideal of capitalism, which is, you know, individual humans tend to have the capital, their time or stuff they have or whatever, and they're free to make things of it. And I think those two combine remarkably well. Ethical capitalism is more profitable most of the time than unethical. And the times we can point at that and say, well, not in this case, these people, or, you know, I've had opportunities in my life to do things that would have been unethical and very profitable. I haven't done them. And they would have worked. Like, that would have been the right thing to do from a financial perspective. But ethically, it's not. Now, maybe that amount of money would have been more than I could have made in my career if I destroyed my career, just taking the money and run. But it's high risk. See, it's a bad call. It's not good capitalism. So as security people, like you and Doug, right, I've valued this entire career working with all sorts of business people who are just doing their best, trying to say, okay, security is this. And you touched on, before I finish my rant, that just this morning talking to Ian Nielsen, our partner in Electric Boats, who's working in a metal fabrication plant, just got a request to, for a nation state customer to know where the steel came from they're using to cut to make things, which is something Ian and I have talked about for the last 4 years about DBOM, right? Get the foundry to actually attest automatically chemical sensors and everything else on high non-refutation repositories and link that out. So you could just point at it and say, there it is. So they had to say, we don't know. We don't know. Don't have that system in place. But the system kind of exists already. You know, I'm buying from, I'm giving you my money. I'm company A, I'm giving you my money, and you're sending me stuff, right? You know, there's information exchange, there's trust exchange. I think most of cybersecurity is just unfolding that and saying, all right, we're just going to confirm. And you both just said exactly what Ian and I were talking about, which is you should be able to say to somebody, yes, we have that. Not see it. They can see that you have it without knowing what's in it. You know, yes, I have a driver's license. You know, you can tell I have a driver's license. No, you know, sign the contract and maybe you can see my driver's license. But until then, you just get to know that I have one. That can be done with technology today. And it's good for business. It's good for security. Unless you're unethical, in which case you probably shouldn't be doing that already.
Well, so there's the notion that responsibility has something to do with it.
Right.
And one of the challenges is we have a lot of not responsible people. Right. And businesses are conglomerates of people, you know, they're composites of all these components. And those composites, you know, one component being bad or a little bit different can cause the whole composite to not behave in a way that's socially acceptable to the other composites it lives with. And, you know, there is no shunning process, or the processes are so obtuse and ridiculous and far away from reality that nothing ever gets shunned. Every once in a while, a business does enough bad stuff over enough period of time that they get punished to the extent of maybe 1% of 1 year's profit. So a lot of companies I'm aware of, you know, when they're faced with a fine or change the way you do the business, they do the analysis, they do the risk management. The risk management comes out, the equation says, no, take the fine. You know, you're making $100 million. The fine's, you know, $1 million per instance when they catch you. And the largest fine ever has been $20 million. And the chance of that happening anytime in the next 10 years is, you know, so small that it's just inconsequential. Just ignore it. Just break the rules. Who cares?
Just this morning, I was talking with the great Brian Martin and debating this sort of thing. And Brian's much more cynical than I am. He's always pointing to corruption and so forth. My point is that, you know, you can make mechanical analogs. No machine is perfect. It's got wear and, you know, it's flopping the bearings and everything else. And this whole free speech, democracy, non-authoritarian, self-forming, call what you will, capitalism experiment since the French Revolution is trying to work through that. And where we see corruption everywhere from petty fiefdom inside a large bureaucracy where someone, because of the way the policy works, can get away with a bunch of unethical crap and slow everything down, up to nation states, is because we're not there yet. We shouldn't be able to do this you know, obtusely, opaquely forever if we actually have these sort of systems in place. If you are, then look, you should be able to argue that. Look, we made $80 million more. Maybe the fines should be higher. But right now, we're not doing it. We can't. I'm a public company. I have to get the $80 million for my retired, you know, little old ladies who invest in my stocks. If you really care about this, it shouldn't be a $1 million fine. And just say it instead of hiding it. I believe in it. I think it's more profitable. I think it's safer, cleaner, faster, easier to be ethical.
Next week on The Cyber Show, the pitch delivers on explosive growth, we hope. Bill discusses cyber education. John gets a nickname, and it's not a nice one, but he likes it. Doug peers into the future and is blinded by the light. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.